from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you will hear an interview with the poet Maggie Smith, author of Good Bones, The Well Speaks of Its Own Poison, Lamp of the Body, and the national bestseller Keep Moving, Notes on Loss, Creativity, and Change. Her latest collection of poems, which we discussed, is Goldenrod, which came out this summer from One Signal. Maggie Smith's poems and essays are widely published and anthologized, appearing in Best American Poetry, The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Paris Review, Plowshares, The Washington Post, The Guardian, and elsewhere. In 2016, her poem Good Bones went viral internationally and has been translated into nearly a dozen languages. Public Radio International called it the official poem of 2016. Maggie Smith's Goldenrod is a collection of poems that look at parenthood, solitude, love, and memory, pulling objects from everyday life, a hallway mirror, a rock found in her son's pocket, a field of goldenrod at the side of the road. She reveals the magic of the present moment. Slate called Smith's superpower as a writer her ability to find the perfect concrete metaphor for inchoate human emotions and explore it with empathy and honesty. I hope you enjoy our conversation, which includes a number of poems from her new collection and some discussion of those poems. In the publisher's description, Goldenrod is described as a collection that reminds us that we decide what is beautiful. And I think that really captures it pretty well, and I loved that. In Good Bones, the publisher's description said that the poet contemplates the past and our future, life and death, childhood and motherhood. So anyway, I'm sure all these collections sort of reflect the themes that have to do with where the poets are in their lives at the given moment that they're writing their poems. But I wondered, setting that aside, to what extent do you have a theme in mind as you work on a collection? Or does the theme sort of come together as the poems come out and maybe you're not that aware of where you're at until you write it down, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I don't have a theme in mind for a book of poems as I'm writing them because I'm not writing a book of poems as a book of poems. Right. And that's the sort of odd thing, at least for my process. I write one poem at a time, usually over several years, because I don't write quickly.
Okay.
So it took me, 5 or 6 years to write the poems in Goldenrod. And I don't know what I'm doing as I'm doing it. So I get an idea for a poem and I write that poem. And then maybe the next day or the next week or the next month or 6 months later, I write another poem. And they all just go into one big folder mm-hmm. on my desktop called New Poems or, something, really hyper organized. And usually what happens is I just fill that up over the course of a few years. And at some point, either because it's been a number of years since my last book came out, or I just noticed that there are a lot of poems in there, I think I probably should print all of this out and see if there's a book to be carved from these poems. And so for Goldenrod, I printed everything out and it was, over 100 poems and started pulling the ones out that didn't feel like they were in conversation okay. with the bulk of them. And then I see the sort of patterns emerge. And that's one of the most exciting times for me is printing out these years of work and sort of seeing what I've been building all along, one brick at a time, but I really didn't know what the shape of it would be. I had no plan. And so for these poems, I printed them all out and I'm like, oh gosh, there are lots of, there's so many flowers and there's so many trees in this book. And I see these walks that I'm taking in this book and my kids are in this book and my divorce and the stuff that I, was grappling with in the news cycle and the pandemic. Yeah. And so, so really it's that time of printing and looking at all the poems is sort of like the time that I step back from the canvas. I have been painting at very closely with my nose an inch from the canvas, doing one leaf at a time, having no idea what kind of tree I've made. And then I stand back and I see, oh, this is what I've been thinking about. This is what I've been ruminating over. This is what the stuff of my brain looks like from the past several years on paper. And that's, it's always sort of surprising.
That's exciting. That must be really exciting. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Thank you. So the new collection is called Goldenrod. And I wondered if we could have you start, you're going to read some of the poems from it. I wonder if you'd be willing to read the title poem now and we can talk about it.
Of course.
Okay, great.
This is Goldenrod. I'm no botanist. If you're the color of sulfur and growing at the roadside, you're goldenrod. You don't care what I call you, whatever you were born as. You don't know your own name. But driving near Peoria, the sky pink-orange, the sun bobbing at the horizon, I see everything is what it is, exactly, in spite of the words I use. Black cows, barns falling in on themselves, you. Dear flowers born with a highway view, forgive me if I've mistaken you, goldenrod, whatever your name is, you are with your own kind. Look, the meadow is a mirror full of you, your reflection repeating. Whatever you are, I see you, wild yellow, and I would let you name me.
Thank you for reading that. I love that poem. And I think one of the things I love about the poem is so often we think of writers and poets specifically maybe as being like all about words and playing with words. And in this one, it's almost like flipped on its head. It's sort of like you can't find the words you find won't necessarily change what it is that you're describing. And I thought that was really fun. You know, a rose by any other name I know has already been said, but I liked that it was being said about goldenrod this time.
Yeah. I mean, I think so many of the poems in this book are about language itself and both the power in words and also their limitations. You know, they can only do so much. They can only do so much, and things are what they are. And they don't know, the goldenrod also doesn't know my name.
Right.
And that's okay.
The poem mentions a meadow as a mirror reflecting goldenrod, which you address directly. So I had two questions about that, that aren't necessarily even maybe about this poem, but when you address an inanimate thing or object in a poem, what do you think that does to kind of bring the poem forward?
You know, that's a good question. I think I'm always thinking, and maybe this is sort of like the empath in me, but I mean, I was the child who would wake up in the middle of the night if a stuffed animal had fallen out of my bed and feel bad and put it back in bed, or would feel a little guilty if I didn't carry like my good luck charm, not because it necessarily gave me good luck, but because I worry that it would feel left behind if I didn't put it in my pocket. And I think that being that kind of child is sort of carried into adulthood, and that I tend to imbue things that do not have souls and hearts and minds, as far as I know, what do we really know, with some of those qualities.
Right.
And so I find myself giving a lot to objects that I might not otherwise. And that's just, I don't necessarily think that's who I am as a poet. I think that's who I am as a person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. That's very empathic though. I mean,
it is.
Yeah. Which I think is tied to poetry maybe. All right. Let's see. This is the second part of that question. I love the mirroring of certain structural aspects of this poem. So you start out, I'm no botanist. And then that line finds a little mirror at the end where I would let you name me. Now, I don't know if I really see that as a mirror now that I'm asking the question, but I guess just beginning and ending in the I narration, I don't know, it felt like a little bit of a framework of naming and starting with your name versus my name. Maybe that was just coincidence.
It is coincidence. And I love that actually, because now I'm looking at it and I begin the poem by saying what I'm not. And then the poem is all about what you may or may not be, this yellow flower. And then I end the poem with, you get to pick what I am.
That's perfect.
Here's the thing. I didn't intend that in the writing of the poem. That's just the way that it happened. And sometimes I think these structures are intuitive, mm-hmm. You know, or we might not consciously craft every single piece of a poem, but sometimes I'll notice things in a poem later, or a reader or a reviewer will notice something in a poem later. And it feels like such a gift to me. And because so much of what I do is intuitive and not, I think I'm going to put this here because earlier I have this mention of this one thing and I want to circle back to it. I do that in some poems. There are poems where I do have a conscious circle back. I want to have an echo of an earlier phrase or an earlier image to sort of tie things together. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I don't do that consciously. I do that sort of subconsciously. And one of the gifts of being read carefully is having other people point things out in your work. So I won't read that poem the same again because of what you just said about it. So thank you.
Thank you. Now I feel so good. All right. So Maggie, I wonder if we can talk a little bit about what your approach is to writing a poem. And I know you've probably been asked this 1,000 times, but I do always find it really interesting to find out, you know, where does a poem start for you and what might bloom as you go?
Yeah, I always write longhand first. I write in a notebook if I have one in my bag, or on the legal pad if I have that handy, or if I don't have anything, I write in the notes function on my iPhone. I'll just type in some lines with my thumbs. It's usually a metaphor or a phrase that gets me going. So if I see something and I'm like, oh, the way that tree is bending reminds me of, or the sound of that bird reminds me of, or the color of this thing is taking me back to this other thing. And so I'll write that thing down. And sometimes it gains momentum right away. And that phrase immediately leads me to think of another sentence, which immediately leads me to another sentence. And I love that. If I can sort of pick up momentum and follow that breadcrumb trail for as long as it will let me until I run out of speed, I will do that. And then I'll kind of come back to it later. But oftentimes all I get is that bit. And that bit might sit in my notebook or on my phone or in a legal pad for that afternoon because I'm off doing other things. Mm-hmm. Or it might sit there for a month because I've forgotten about it. And then I'll stumble upon it later when I go to write the next thing down and I look and I see there's a scrap on the facing page. I've never done a thing with that. Maybe I should write that down and see if I can extract some more from it. So it's a very piecemeal process. It does not happen every day. It does not happen in the same place. It does not happen at the same time. It does not happen reliably. So it is very much sort of, I try to have my little antenna up all the time. And that just means paying attention, you know, seeing and listening and sort of tuning in and kind of writing things down as I get them and dealing with them as I have time.
Do you feel like writing them down in these places that you've mentioned keeps the antenna up in a way? Because like if you were to take a break from writing things down, do you think you'd notice as much?
I don't know. I think I probably would. I was thinking about this the other day. You know, if someone told me I could never write another poem, if there was some dystopian film where the act of writing was like, you know, actually removed years from your life or would hurt your children or something like that. If I could never write down another poem because of some contract of that kind, I would still be writing poems. I would just be writing them in my head because really, you know, poetry is not just the thing I write down. It's the way I see the world. So what I'm writing down is what I'm thinking. And the writing it down isn't what makes it a poem. I mean, I don't know if I'm really articulating that. I think I think like a poet. So even if I weren't writing it down, I think that process would still be happening internally.
There's like a composition that's going on that doesn't have to do with paper.
and that I cannot turn off. I mean, that I know. I mean, even when I go through the sort of fallow times when I'm not writing a lot, I'm still processing things internally in that way. Like, I don't know how, I have been doing it for long enough that I don't know how to see things in a purely literal way. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to look at clouds and not start trying. Like my instant instinct when I see or hear something is to try to capture it in language. And usually that includes comparing it to something else.
I don't write very many poems, but I do write fiction. And the funny thing that happens to me, and it seems just to happen in a certain part of the writing process, so it's not always, but if I'm working on a novel, that narrator will be narrating like literally as I walk through the produce section. And it's like, shut up.
And then she picked up the broccoli.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. My kids actually tease me because we'll be walking and I'll see something and I'm like, oh my gosh, you guys, look at that. Doesn't that totally look like XYZ? And they're like, yeah, mom. Or, you know, my son will be like, we know it's a metaphor, you know? So it's just, it is what it is. I don't know how to be another kind of person. And so for me, really writing poetry is just a way of making the thing that my brain does already useful and shareable. But if I wasn't writing it down, it would still be who I am as a person.
Just based on the conversation we've just had, and particularly about noticing objects and then letting them work their way into a poem. So I have a question that might be relevant to that about Talisman.
Oh, sure.
Your poem called Talisman.
Talisman. They look like gifts a crow might bring a human girl desperate to impress her. In the left pocket of my thrifted emerald coat, a scuffed acorn, a glassy black stone, one pink Mr. Potato Head ear. When I touch them, I can believe almost anything. Who's to say they can't keep me safe? Who's to say a bird can't court someone's daughter? But in this life, it's my son who shows his love like a creature that clever, leaving treasures for my fingers to worry against. I carry them like anything I love until they warm in my palm. Until I believe. Walking alone at night, the sky feathered blue black and slowly folding over me, I pocket my left hand and tell myself a story about my life, a story I call Talisman, a story that might end well if I tell it right.
Thank you for reading that. That is so beautiful. I almost hate to pull it apart. But I'm going to pull it apart. No, from a craft perspective, and I just feel like because we just talked about noticing things, noticing objects, and then, you know, writing them down. So anyway, in this poem, you found the objects in your pocket. I assume that actually happened. Yeah,
it did. Oh, yeah. Good. I posted a photo on my Instagram this week of these three objects in my pocket and said, sometimes poems are half invented and some come fully from the life, and this one comes fully from the life.
Oh, that's wonderful. So when did the crow come? So like once you wrote down maybe or thought about these objects and started kind of letting them roll around in your head a little bit, did the crow come early on as a blackbird that steals shiny objects, or did that come later or in a different way? How did that come to be?
I think the crow came fairly early on. I had read an article years ago about a little girl who had sort of a pet crow who would bring shiny things and leave them in the bird bath in the backyard. And I think once her mother lost the cap to her camera lens, and the crow knew to bring it back and leave it at the house. And so she had this sort of like tackle box almost of all of these classified objects that this one crow had left as gifts for this girl. And I was so jealous because I love crows. I have a real love for corvids in general. They're so smart. And so when I was thinking about these objects that my son, you know, puts in his pockets or puts in my pockets, I remembered that article, and they do really look like gifts that a crow might bring a young girl, as you know. And what does it mean when a crow sort of forms an attachment with a human? But in this case, the clever creature is not a crow. It's my little boy. And actually this is a poem, you know, speaking of goldenrod and that sort of mirroring, this is a poem where I consciously brought the crow back.
Right.
In the description.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the description of the sky is as blue black and folding over me like a wing was a conscious sort of echo of the crow from the beginning, because I wanted to find a way to bring that image back without necessarily bringing a physical bird
right? I loved that that the blue-black is feathered. Although I found that both protective and a little startling, like this image folding over.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's protective, but it also feels a little ominous at the same time. And this poem was written, during my night pandemic walks, when I could go out late at night and not wear a mask and not worry about having to cross the road or be around other people. And so it was also written during a time where things felt quite sheltered and yet ominous, yes. Which is sort of that image.
Wonderful. It's so good to know what that backstory is, because yeah. I think that's even more perfect now that I kind of know the story. And I love, too, that your story, might end well if you tell it right, you, the poet. If this narrator's story might end well if she tells it right, it's like there's a sort of not knowing there that kind of is in keeping with this sort of not sure, darkness, not darkness. Yeah.
I agree. And to me, that feels it's like maybe one of the more sort of Ars Poetica moments that I've written in my own work, which is I feel I'm constantly trying to like write the poem, and whatever that poem is, I'm always trying to write the poem, and maybe everything will turn out well if I can just say this thing correctly, if I can just get it right. But no, I didn't. So I have to write another poem. And the sort of idea that if I could just write the one golden, perfect poem that says everything I've ever wanted to say, that I could just stop doing it, but it'll never happen. So there's always another poem to write. Right. That sort of like never finished, never satisfied feeling both in life and in the work.
Mm-hmm. I love this one. Could you read December 18th, 2008?
Of course. December 18th, 2008. For just a fraction of a moment that afternoon, if we think of time as being a whole, you were the newest person in the world. You were the emptiest vessel on earth, knowing nothing of this place or of yourself, that you even were a self, that a self was something one could be, that one could be at all, and what was being. For that narrowest sliver of a whole, you were the least experienced person on earth, and then you weren't. You knew me before you knew your own body, what to do with your hands, your pink fists battering your face. We swaddled you as if against that confusion, though I tell you, that confusion never leaves. The body remains a house unaware of its rooms.
Mm, thank you for reading that one, too. First of all, I loved this idea that for a moment, an infant is the least experienced person on earth. I mean, that was really cool to think about. and that you could reinvent the wonder of new life, which has been studied forever. I loved that you were able to kind of make me think new about that. Craft-wise, one thing I noticed about this poem, which I really enjoyed once I noticed it and read it over a few times, is that the opening words are all, not all, but a lot about size, fraction, whole, emptiest, narrowest sliver. And then once you start talking about this specific child, the language becomes a lot more, I don't know if I'm saying lyrical, but, pink fists battering your face, swaddled, that last lovely line about the house. So, how much of this is intended? Did you intend for it to move in that way from sort of a kind of like abstract into more specific, let's say?
No. I mean, the poem begins really abstractly because that's what I was thinking. And then as I got to my specific child, it becomes very concrete and specific. And I think, tender in a way that abstraction cannot be. It's hard to speak tenderly about time as a construct, but very easy to speak tenderly of one's infant that must be swaddled because it keeps, smacking itself in the head. This poem was written very quickly, more quickly than most poems I write. This one was drafted, in less than an hour in one sitting. And I think looking at it now and the sort of like unspooling of those clauses and sort of like the questions that I'm asking, that's sort of, I'm thinking, I can see myself thinking on the page. I'm sort of thinking out loud on the page. And so that's really, I mean, the poem as you see it is more or less the poem as I drafted it that day. And that doesn't always happen. Sometimes I draft a poem and then I go back and I think, actually the end should be the beginning, or actually the middle is unnecessary. Or I was revving my engines for the first three stanzas, but the poem really begins halfway down the page and I can jettison all of that. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the poem remains pretty much the same structure and order that it was originally drafted in, because I liked the idea that I found my way into the poem via this abstract concept, which sort of led me down a corridor of abstraction into this, for lack of a better word, room, where I found my actual daughter. And then that led me even into a smaller room where I think about the self and not just her, but me, and how do we ever really know ourselves? Do we ever really know this life or who we are? Many questions do not get answered, and there is no way to sort of guard against this sort of constant seeking. And so in some ways it gets more, it then sort of explodes out again in that last sentence.
Yeah. And it's interesting because that's something that you already said earlier in this interview, the same thing about like the poems are seeking answers and life is seeking answers and we won't get them. And so you have to write more poems.
And so you just have to write more poems. Yeah. I mean, I find that life and work is sort of Q and A, very heavy on the Q and light on the A. And that's just how it is. And the better, the more comfortable I can get with not knowing, I think the better I do at living this life and the better I do at writing it.
Yeah. All right. Well, in talking about asking questions, that reminds me of a couple of other poems that you were going to read. And you suggested these and I do feel like they keep really good company together. So I'm wondering if you can read them one and then the other before we talk about them. So it's Wife for Scale and Bride.
Yep. And they come right after one, right after the other in the book.
Right.
Wife for Scale. This is a tender age, and in geologic time, hardly an age at all, but a golden band of rock pressed paper thin will stand for these years, a kind of scientific shorthand. Once I had a professor whose wife was in every photo he took of rock formations. He'd click through slide after slide saying, "My wife for scale." Isn't there always a woman in the picture? And isn't she always small in comparison? Forgive me, that was my grief talking. Tell me, how do I teach myself to be alone? The strata for this age will not be the first to reveal what salt does to stone, as if a sea had been here and not sadness only. Tell me, with God a question, where is solace but in the earth? The soil I'm standing on in this moment, even as it shifts beneath my feet, as it gives and cannot hold me, will be rock.
Wonderful.
And this is Bride. How long have I been wed to myself, calling myself darling, dressing for my own pleasure, each morning choosing perfume to turn me on? How long have I been alone in this house, but not alone, married less to the man than to the woman silvering with the mirror? I know the kind of wife I need, and I become her, the one who will leave this earth at the same instant I do. I am my own bride, lifting the veil to see my face. Darling, I say, I have waited for you all my life.
Thank you very much for reading both of those. There's lots I want to talk about with these poems, but one of the things I wanted to ask about was questioning. In Wife for Scale, the poet seems to be questioning the reader, or maybe the universe, you know, sort of how do I teach myself to be alone doesn't seem a question that the poet is asking herself necessarily. And there are other, you know, where is solace but in the earth? And then in the next poem, she's definitely asking herself questions, I think. How long have I been wed to myself is not something that anybody but the poet could answer, right? So I liked that in going from the first poem, which is definitely, to me, a more vulnerable poem, to the next poem, which is a lot more confident and comfortable and self-appreciative, that she's gone from asking questions of other people to asking questions of herself. So I was just...
I have to say, that's so interesting to me. I wrote Bride before I wrote Wife for Scale, and I wrote Bride in probably the hardest month I've lived.
Wow.
In like the middle of my divorce, when I knew like nothing of what was coming for me. And so I in some ways I think, okay, it was almost like sort of aspirational confidence.
Yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
I need to tell myself that it's going to be okay. And so I'm having this talk with the woman in the mirror and I'm telling her, you're going to be okay.
Right.
Even if the person who's on this side of the mirror is not yet in that place, I'm sort of speaking to a future version of myself. Mm-hmm. So I love that because, yeah, the order of the poems in the book is not the order in which they were written.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's really interesting. The other thing, when you talk about how it's aspirational, that reminds me of, again, in Talisman, you know, if I tell the story correctly or if I tell the story well, it will come out okay in the end. I'm not saying that line correctly, but all right. Wonderful. I want to talk a little bit about imagery. So in Wife for Scale, you utilize geologic imagery, rock formations, strata, salt to stone, shifting soil, which was really interesting as far as framing what the narrator is going through in her personal life. And in Bride, it's sort of like, it's more of a frame of a wedding. I mean, not just a wedding, but perfume and mirror and veil would all be found on a wedding day too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the bride is herself. So I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about finding the right imagery to describe an emotional moment.
Yeah. I mean, in Wife for Scale, that poem really began with me remembering in sort of a comical way this professor.
I laughed out loud because I could just...
I mean, I'm in a dark room in college and he's just clicking through these, there's my Wife for Scale. I know in smaller pictures, it would be a pencil or a cup or something, but for the rock formations, because he went on all these trips with his wife, there's just this woman, you know, in khaki shorts standing in all of his photos. And it struck me for two reasons. One, the thing that he was really illustrating to us or wanting us to pay attention to was always bigger than the woman, which is why she was needed there. And that metaphorically felt important to me. Like my work is bigger than this personal thing. And I started thinking a lot about geologic time as I was writing my last book, Keep Moving, and the idea that in the moment when things are really hard, it's hard to get perspective. But if you pull way back and think of time as a really long timeline, or think of it as a really, really long timeline, it becomes more manageable. And so the idea that this time is actually, again, going back to the last poem, this is a sliver of time. This is a sliver of a whole. This is one blip, one little band of rock. And actually, like these couple of years in a rock formation would be too narrow to even be able to see. It doesn't even count. It's not an age. This is nothing. And so trying to use the bands of rock as a metaphor to make myself realize the scale of the problem, which feels inverse to how it feels when you're living it, that I found helpful. And also, you know, sort of slyly funny, being able to pull.
And the fact that it's a golden band was interesting too, right? Yeah.
That was not an accident.
Okay. All right.
That was not an accident. And the line break is not an accident. You know, I think, you know, one of the things I fuss over a lot in my poems are line breaks. How do I get a meaningful phrase or word or how do I work perhaps an opportunity for a double meaning or some sort of suspense or surprise into an enjambment, into a line break. And so Golden Band is one of them. Also, Isn't There Always a Woman in the Picture? Is another one. I mean, I think my sense of humor shows a bit in some of these line breaks, and in Bride, you know, the one who will leave break this earth at the same instant break. I do. I am my own bride. Having the opportunity to get the words "I do" on its own line as a vow to oneself. I saw that as a formal opportunity in the poem. And that would have been a lost opportunity if I hadn't broken the line before those two words. Now, every reader may not pick up on that particular moment, but I know it's there and I put it there for a reason.
The other thing that strikes me as far as the order that these poems were written in is, you know, those are important, that what you're saying about the line breaks, but in Bride, it's far less humorous. And there I can kind of see the order that these were written in more, because by Wife for Scale, you've got a little bit of a sense of humor about all of this.
Yep.
And that's interesting,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Greater perspective,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because of the Wife for Scale.
Because of the Wife for Scale.
Let's talk a little bit about writing poems that consider personal material. And I always wonder about this with people who write memoir, too. I remember a book about Lucy Grayley that was written by Ann Patchett. And they were good friends. And Ann Patchett said that it used to really devastate her that she would go to readings of her work, and instead of being asked about the poems, she was asked about her cancer, her surgeries, her face, right? So when you are presenting your material, is it ever hard for you that you're presenting personal material? And do people question you about that aspect of the poetry, or do they pretty much respect that boundary, if there is one?
I think people do ask questions of that. And I think people ask questions about the personal material in poems more of women writers than they do of men. I think men get more craft questions, and I think it is not unusual for women to get more content-related questions. Like, the more that changes, the happier I am. But again, I mean, I'm writing the poems, so I'm putting the material in there, and I am prepared. If I publish a book of poems or essays or a memoir or anything, I am prepared to get questions about both the craft and the material, because people are curious. People are inherently curious. You know, it's just part of the gig, I think, to answer both kinds of questions and to set boundaries when, if there are things you don't want to talk about, to be able to say, I don't really feel like that's relevant, or I'm not comfortable answering that question. Or if you want to ask me something about craft, I'd love to answer it for you.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Great. Let's see. So I have a few more questions, and we also had one more poem to read. So I'm trying to figure out which order I want to go in. Let me ask you first, have you read any books lately that you would recommend to listeners? I always like to ask if anyone's, and it doesn't have to be poetry. It can be whatever you're enjoying.
Yeah. So right now I am simultaneously reading Maggie Nelson's On Cruelty.
Okay.
Eula Biss's Having and Being Had. And Rachel Yoder's Night Bitch. None of them are poetry, but I'm also constantly reading poetry. But those are the three books that I'm working my way through now, and I'm loving all of them. I sort of have a house full of books that I may die before I get to all of them, but it doesn't stop me from buying more of them and piling them up around me. And just like loving on them and loving being surrounded by them and knowing that they're there should I ever get snowed in or, you know, for example, if we had a pandemic and I couldn't leave my house for a year, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
If that hypothetically were ever to happen, I'll be fine. Yeah.
Did you read On Immunity during the pandemic or before?
I read it before. And I thought, well, goodness, talk about a book that I'm glad to have read and that is so needed in these times.
Right, right. And I should say that's by Eulabis too. She was on the show to talk about that one. I have not read Having and Being Had yet, but
it's terrific.
Yeah. Okay. And then how about your own work? What are you writing? I mean, it's hard to talk about what you're writing if it's just poem and poem and poem, and probably you don't have a new collection since it takes a while for those.
No, it takes a ton. I mean, I am writing new poems, which is wonderful. I had a day a couple of weeks ago where I wrote three poems in a day. And wow. I actually don't know I've ever had a three poem day before in my, 30 years of writing poems. And I texted a friend, I feel possessed in a good way. And I think maybe they had just been sort of percolating in the brain for a while and then all chose the same day to finally coalesce. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the best days I've had in a really long time. Mm-hmm. There's no other feeling quite like that. So I'm working on poems, and I'm in edits on a picture book actually for kids. So the next stage of that will be finding the illustrator and going through that sort of collaborative process.
Is the picture book a poetry book? No.
It is not. No. I mean, it's poetic. I'd say it's very lyrical the way that picture books are, but it's not like a rhyming picture book.
It's a single work. It's not like a poem on each page or something.
Nope. It's a single work.
Wonderful. That's exciting. What's the theme of the picture book?
It's sort of a bedtime book about sort of a mother and child bedtime book about overcoming sort of bedtime anxiety.
Oh, nice.
And filling oneself with good thoughts before bed.
That sounds wonderful. Let's see. I wonder now if you can read How Dark the Beginning.
Sure. How Dark the Beginning. All we ever talk of is light. Let there be light. There was light then, good light. But what I consider dawn is darker than all that. So many hours between the day receding and what we recognize as morning, the sun cresting like a wave that won't break over us, as if light were protective, as if no hearts were flayed, no bodies broken on a day like today. In any film, the sunrise tells us everything will be all right. Danger wouldn't dare show up now, dragging its shadow across the screen. We talk so much of light, please, let me speak on behalf of the good dark. Let us talk more of how dark the beginning of a day is.
Thank you. You do this a little bit in a number of works, and that is sort of like turning something on its head. I think I said that once before, maybe for Goldenrod. Offering the opposite of what we think we know to make us think more about what we don't know, And I love this sort of playing with good light and good dark. So that was really fun. You talked a little bit about form a minute ago. This poem is written in couplets, and mm-hmm. each line is around 7 or 8 syllables. Yet, is it a certain form or is it not a form?
It's not a form. No, I mean, couplets is sort of, I joke that if there were a support group for couplets, I would have to join and stand up and say, hi, I'm Maggie, and I like to write poems in couplets. it's my favorite stanza. If I could only write in one shape or form for the rest of my life, anybody who knows me knows what I'd choose, and it's couplets. I'm glad I don't have to pick. I'm glad that I can let the poem dictate the form that it wants to choose, and as it does. But so many of my poems really seem to want to be in couplets, and I think part of what I love about it is the amount of white space that really lets the lines kind of like breathe and get emphasis, and it slows down the reader. It makes you really kind of take in every line and every line break. And so that I just love. But almost all of my poems would look like this if I were left to my own devices.
Do you ever write like that and then just take out all the lines and go like, okay, we're going to do something different?
Yeah. I mean, oftentimes what I do now is if I find myself starting to draft a poem, it doesn't ever come out in couplets. I mean, I draft a poem and it's just a mess on a notebook page. And then when I go and put it into the computer, oftentimes the first thing I'll try is a couplet because it's just sort of my default. It's like Garamond 12 is my default font. Couplet is my default stanza. But then I have to justify it to myself. You know, is it really supposed to be in couplets? Is the line length really supposed to be this? And so then I try different things. I'll try it in prose. What does that do? If I look at it as a chunk, as a paragraph, what happens if I put it in, if I let two couplets live together and I put it in quatrains and I cut the white space in half? What does that do? What if it's a tercet? What if it's a tercet with a single line and then another tercet? What if I'm alternating? What if it wants to be one big column of text down the page with no relief for the reader, no white space where they can sort of gather their thoughts and continue? How does that change it? And so really what I'm doing is reading it out loud and seeing it on the page in several different forms and seeing what feels intuitively right to me for its final version.
Okay, wonderful. I always like to finish by asking for advice. And in your case, I've never asked about this before, but I noticed on your website that you offer editorial advice. You do that as a consultation business. So in your work as an editor of poetry, how do you offer advice that both transforms work that needs help and maintains the poet's own voice? I would think that would be even harder with poetry than it might be with prose. I'm not sure. I do a little bit of editorial work for friends, but I would be paralyzed if I tried to help someone with their poetry because I feel like I would be imposing my voice.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky. I think whether it's, you know, in a class I'm teaching or a workshop I'm teaching or giving someone advice on a poem, it's tricky because I know what I would do if it were my poem, but it's not my poem. And so it's part of it is up to the mentee or the client or the student to be able to hold a strong vision for the work so they can balance both my feedback or peer feedback or workshop feedback against their vision for the poem. And that will help you weed out the stuff that like doesn't align with what you're trying to do. You can easily kind of shove that aside as well-meaning, but not really what you need to hear. And then if people seem to get what you're doing, then you can sort of put that advice into a different pile of things to try. And so I guess what I would say is what I try to do as both an editor and as a teacher is ask a lot of questions and show poets different possibilities for what a poem might do. Like, have you thought about what would happen if you changed the title? What would happen if you began it here? What would happen if you lopped off the last stanza? What would happen if you didn't begin this way? What would happen if it were in a different form? What would happen if these questions became statements or vice versa? So a lot of what I'm doing is trying to sort of poke people into trying out different things so that they can find the version of the poem that is both more refined than the version they've given me, but also more refined and theirs, not more refined and mine.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. I want to mention again, the name of the collection is Goldenrod. It's a new book of poems by Maggie Smith, and it is published by One Signal Publishers. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
No, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the poet Maggie Smith. You can learn more about her work at her website, maggiesmithpoet.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Maggie Smith, and it is based on the work of Joe Brainard, who's come up on the show before. He wrote a book called I Remember. The book is essentially prose poetry, and each line begins with the words, I remember. And Maggie says that the idea is that if you write that way over and over and over for a couple of pages in a big rush without editing yourself or self-censoring, or even trying, you might find yourself connecting ideas that you might otherwise not have. And so she says to consider first thought, best thought, and then use the material to mine through for new poems and projects. This same book was recommended in an earlier prompt suggested by my guest Lauren Fox last winter. So I'm betting it's a great exercise to try. But to put another spin on it, in case you've already tried it, thanks to Lauren's suggestion, I'll additionally suggest that you try writing lines that begin instead with the words, "I miss." Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. So here's a reminder to listeners who write. I do share a writing prompt each week on the show, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book. You can listen to the interview and then hear the writing prompt, or you can just look at the podcast site. I write out that week's prompt each week on the podcast site in case you missed it. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have any events to announce. I just announced those events from those bookstores and the South Burlington Library. We have dozens of libraries in Vermont, but I only really announce events that are sent to me. So if you are an author and you have an event happening and you'd like me to mention it the week that it's supposed to come up, I will do so in the calendar. If you work at a library and want me to announce your library events that are book-related, send them my way. If I have time, I always like to announce the Bookworm's calendar. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book. The podcast site is writethebook.podbean.com, but we are also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and like it on social media, talk about it, tweet about it, whatever it is that you might participate in social media wise, or else just talk to your friends about it and get in touch and let me know what you think. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.